Last year, advocates say that there were at least 26 deaths of transgender women due to violence, the majority of whom were Black transgender women. This year, unfortunately, those numbers appear to be on track of reaching that same high. Kansas City has not been immune to that trend. Last month, 32-year-old Brooklyn Lindsay, a Black transgender woman, was found shot to death. And just this past Friday, a man was charged with her murder after investigators made connections with DNA evidence. I'm Michelle Tyreen Johnson, filling in for Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR Central Standard. Today, we're talking about transgender violence against women of color and its impact on our community. Today, I'm talking with Sarah McBride from the Human Rights Campaign. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yes. Sarah, where are you right now? Where are you located? Where's the Human Rights Campaign?
Well, the Human Rights Campaign is a national LGBTQ civil rights organization. We're headquartered in Washington, D.C. I'm actually joining you from Wilmington, Delaware, where I work remotely for HRC.
Okay. So because I know I've heard of Human Rights Campaign and I know how much work you do in this area. Could you give a little backdrop on explaining to people who aren't aware of just how prevalent violence against the transgender community is? I mean, is this an upward trend or is it an issue that people are actually just hearing about?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Right now, as a community, transgender people find ourselves facing an epidemic of violence. As you mentioned during the intro, at least 26 transgender people, mostly transgender women of color, were killed last year. This year, in fact, just this past weekend, the number for this year rose to at least 12 transgender people killed, all Black transgender women. Now, we're a small community, and the community of transgender women of color is obviously even smaller. So these numbers are significant. And every time we talk about them, we say at least, because we believe that there are more transgender victims of fatal violence whose deaths go unreported or misreported. And this violence, it is both violence that is explicitly hateful, violence that would be classified as a statutory hate crime, but it's also violence that's been influenced by hate, violence that's been influenced by the discrimination, the stigma, and the social rejection that transgender people too often face that push them into the shadows and out of mainstream society's general structures of safety and security.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you were talking to our producers, you had a really succinct way of putting it, that there are hate crimes, the traditional hate crimes, mm-hmm. that I think we all sort of have a concept of what that is. But in this case, there's also the crimes of identity.
Well, that's right. And obviously, there are some of these crimes are crimes that would be classified as legal hate crimes, where anti-trans bias is very clearly the primary motivator of the violence. But when transgender people face discrimination, social rejection, family rejection that pushes them onto the street, out of stable employment and stable housing, into underground economies, outside of mainstream society's traditional structures of security and support, they're going to be more likely to face violence. And even beyond that, even if the violence is, for instance, intimate partner violence or violence outside of underground economies, we know that the stigmatization and the dehumanization of transgender lives lowers the bar for perpetrators of violence to reach before they inflict fatal violence. And so we say that this is hate-based and hate-influenced violence because at the end of the day, the societal context with which this violence occurs can't be separated from the individual acts of violence. And that context is a context of hate and vitriol. And while this is hate that has always existed, there's no question that we're seeing a rising trend of hate that coincides with anti-transgender political attacks and anti-transgender political rhetoric.
Right. And I mean, it's with all discrimination. So often I hear people talk about, well, oh, that's really on the increase, or that's just happening lately. And it's like, no, it's just that between social media and little computers in our hands, people have the ability to know more and talk about these things more.
That's absolutely correct. And one of the things that's so important as we talk about this epidemic of violence, and as we, I think, rightfully acknowledge that there appears to be a general increase in hate crimes in the United States, that some of the increase, particularly some of the increase around our general perceptions and awareness of this, is a byproduct of increased competency within law enforcement and the media to accurately report on these crimes. Obviously, as you mentioned, the prevalence of social media, bringing this information to our fingertips. So it's both a dynamic and epidemic of violence that has always existed, that we're just getting a clearer picture of, and at the same time, one that does appear to be increasing by objective metrics that should have included prior to 4 or 5 years ago these types of crimes. So I think it's a both and situation where there's an increasing social awareness of this due to increasingly accurate reporting, but also no question that that transgender people ourselves, particularly transgender women of color, are reporting a more vitriolic and dangerous environment that transgender people find ourselves in.
And, you know, you mentioned, Sarah, two pillars that I was going to ask you about anyway. One, I'll start with the police. So is that where you get primarily your data from in terms of determining the number, both the increase or just the number itself?
Well, unfortunately, federal hate crimes data collection is optional at this point. So in many cases, law enforcement jurisdictions will report zero or no technical hate crimes in their jurisdictions, even when we know that's false. The data that we utilize is based on publicly available information that typically comes out through media reports, which are byproducts of initial police reports. And oftentimes, initial police reports might, one, just classify a transgender woman, for instance, as a man, which would mean that we have no idea that the victim was transgender. In other cases, and this is oftentimes raises a red flag for us, we know that the victim may have been trans, the media reports will initially classify the victim as "quote unquote" a man in a dress. Mm. Now, this misreporting and underreporting of these crimes is incredibly dangerous because when law enforcement misgenders or misnames transgender victims of violence, even if their legal documentation still has their birth name and the sex they were assigned at birth, when law enforcement goes out and does that, which too often happens, it has dangerous consequences for a whole host of reasons. One, if law enforcement is misgendering the transgender victim of violence, it's going to seed further distrust within the community, making it harder to get the information that they need to perform their investigations and making it more difficult to equitably serve that community. Second is that in their own individual investigation, if they're going out into a community misgendering and misnaming the transgender victim of violence, that could be confusing for the community that only knew that victim by their chosen name and their pronouns. But then the final reason why it's dangerous is because when law enforcement and by extension the media unintentionally or intentionally misgender transgender victims of violence, it reinforces the very prejudice at the heart of this violence in the first place. And so from a practical standpoint, it's incredibly dangerous and counterproductive. But from a broader standpoint, from a societal standpoint, it can unintentionally reinforce and enhance the very prejudice and hate at the center of this epidemic of violence.
Well, and then that's the lead into the other group I was going to ask you about. I mean, in your opinion, what role does journalism have in making sure that there's a more accurate awareness of this issue?
Well, fortunately, we've seen significant progress in the media when it comes to coverage of anti-transgender violence. And I will also say we've seen progress in many law enforcement jurisdictions around the more equitable service toward the LGBTQ community and more accurate reporting of these crimes. Not enough progress for sure. But in media, we are seeing more and more media serving as a watchdog that when law enforcement does misgender or misreport the victim's gender identity, that oftentimes media will correct that or will reach back out to law enforcement to try to push for more information and clarity as to whether the victim was transgender. One of the important things, though, that we try to impress upon the media beyond the name and pronoun issue is that so often these crimes get reduced just to a headline and the sensational nature of the crime. But what's so important for all of us to remember is that behind these headlines and behind these stories are real people with hopes and dreams, people with friends and family, people who had entire lives ahead of them that were tragically cut short. And so one of the things that's so important for us to reinforce in our own work and for us to impart upon the media is that we need to make sure that when we report on these crimes, when we talk about this epidemic of violence, we never lose the humanity at the center of this issue, at the center of these lives, that these were real people who were worthy of dignity, life, and fairness.
That's such a great point. That's such an amazing point, because I'm sure that you do see, as with, you know, other things that are covered, that people get so focused on covering the issue that they don't cover the people behind the issue. Especially when we're talking about people who had lives, who were loved, and who were at least trying to live lives of joy before this happened. As part of your work in looking at data, because again, I'm a Midwesterner, and I'm calling you from the Midwest, and you know, I'm used to people when I go on the coast. Whenever there's something that comes up that is like this, they go, "Oh, that happens in the Midwest," as if we too don't have the exact same issues. Do you see any trends in terms of reporting? Like, for example, does the Midwest tend to underreport, overreport? Is our law enforcement, is it in the pocket compared to larger metropolises? I mean.
You know, I think it's a patchwork, and some jurisdictions are better than others, and there's not necessarily a hard and fast rule on you know, where are the best places. Now, obviously, certain jurisdictions or certain law enforcement agencies in larger jurisdictions in progressive cities oftentimes are at the forefront in many ways of at least adopting explicitly tailored policies and practices. But it's really a patchwork. And I think in Kansas City, there was a real attempt by law enforcement to work with advocates to make sure that the service toward the transgender community was improved and has been improved. But it's really a patchwork across the country. One of the things we do see, I will say, is that there is no question that every year we also see a flare up of violence in particular jurisdictions, in particular areas. And so far, those flare-ups have predominantly occurred in places where there aren't explicit statewide non-discrimination protections, and predominantly in the American South. So one year, for instance, we saw a flare-up of violence in the state of Louisiana against transgender women of color, where several transgender women of color were killed within the state within a matter of weeks.
Oh, wow.
In Jacksonville last year, we saw a situation over the course of a few months where three transgender women were killed and one transgender person was nearly fatally stabbed. In Dallas this year, we've seen two transgender women killed within just a matter of weeks. And there's not necessarily a clear rationale for why these flare-ups exist in these specific areas. But what we do know is that violence breeds violence. And when the violence occurs, it gives license to others to commit violence. And particularly when they see law enforcement misgendering or misnaming the victim, when they see the media disrespectfully reporting on it, that only emboldens and gives greater license to that violence. And in Jacksonville, I think was the best, or at least the most powerful example of this, because in Jacksonville, it was one of the largest flare-ups of violence we've seen. And that was also simultaneously occurring while law enforcement was intentionally and persistently misgendering the transgender victims of violence.
Man, you know, that reminds me of another question I want to ask you, because it's all about connections. So how does this violence connect to the other aspects of societal inclusion or exclusion of the transgender community, such as discrimination?
And that's such an important question. And that's one of the reasons why we call this hate-based and hate-influenced violence. Because at the end of the day, there's no question that when transphobia mixes with misogyny and racism, it can have often deadly consequences, which is why we see that the vast majority of transgender victims of violence are transgender women of color. And as I mentioned this year, every transgender victim of violence that we know of was a Black transgender woman. And it's also no coincidence that transgender women of color, particularly Black transgender women, disproportionately face the discrimination and violence that comes our community's way writ large. And so when transgender people are pushed out of stable employment because of discrimination and employment based on gender identity, they're pushed into underground economies, including survival sex work, where they're pushed into circumstances where violence may be more likely and where they may be more vulnerable to that violence because they're pushed out of traditional structures of security and safety and regulations of security and safety. When transgender people are rejected by their family or pushed out of stable housing and even temporary housing due to discrimination and they're pushed onto the streets, violence is more likely in those contexts as well. And so the discrimination that transgender people face in employment, in housing, in public spaces, including temporary homeless shelters, that discrimination pushes transgender people to the margins of society where they're less protected and more likely to face discrimination. And again, it's not a coincidence, we believe, that much of this violence occurs in areas where there are no clear statewide non-discrimination protections. Because I think most people think that discrimination is wrong and therefore is illegal, clearly and explicitly. But the reality is that in a majority of states and at the federal level, LGBTQ people still do not have clear protections from discrimination in employment, in housing, and in public spaces. That discrimination, which is unfortunately not protected under state law in most places, that discrimination disproportionately targets the very communities we see reflected in these numbers and in this epidemic of violence, and that's Black transgender women.
Wow. I mean, you're talking about people already on the margins and then being on the margins of the margins. That's what I'm hearing. I have one last question for you, Sarah, before we sort of wrap this up. I'm not one of those people that believes when we're talking about discrimination that we should aim for the, you know, looking for the light at the end of the tunnel, because sometimes we just have to be in the tunnel to accept where we are. But is there anything you can speak to about how we take this forward, how we somehow move forward in putting more light on the things that, because that's where I see the light, not the light at the end of the tunnel, but shedding more light on this. What any thoughts on that?
You know, I think there are three things that come to mind, and I think that's an important question to ask. The first is that we are seeing more cities and states adopting non-discrimination protections. We saw at the federal level, the House of Representatives become the first time in American history that a chamber of Congress has passed a comprehensive LGBTQ civil rights bill. We're seeing more and more law enforcement jurisdictions and media accurately reporting on these crimes. We're also seeing that the transgender community, particularly transgender communities, are organizing and mobilizing in new and unprecedented ways, having their voices heard in more and increasing ways throughout society. And that's really powerful. And at the end of the day, one of the things that I reflect on as we hit 50 years since the Stonewall Uprising, oftentimes it's in our biggest challenges that we take our most significant steps forward. It was in the response to police violence at the Stonewall Inn that our modern movement began. It was during the depths of the HIV and AIDS epidemic that our infrastructure was built and our advocacy was honed. It was in the 2000s when marriage ban after marriage ban passed in states across the country that conversations began that laid the foundation for marriage equality to come to every state in this land much faster than people anticipated. And I think it's in this moment of unprecedented attacks on the transgender community, whether it's explicit legislative attacks, whether it's in the discrimination or the violence that we're seeing. It's in this moment that the community is organizing like never before, that our voices, particularly the voices of transgender women of color, are being heard in new ways and ways that will lay the foundation for hearts to be opened and minds to be changed, laws to be passed, and for greater inclusion in society in the long run.
Thank you, Sarah. I mean, thank you sincerely for this discussion about a really difficult but an important subject.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. We have to take a quick break, but next up, we'll be talking about craftivism. You'll have to come back to hear exactly what that is. This is Michelle Tyrene Johnson, and this is Central Standard. Please don't go away. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, and this is KCUR Central Standard, and we're now about to talk about craftivism. I'm sure you're wondering what's that. I've had to explain that to about four people this morning at KCUR. When people think of knitting and crocheting, they don't typically think of activism. And when people think of activism, knitting needles and crochet hooks are not the protest tools that tend to jump to mind. But recently, a website called Ravelry, the Facebook for knitters and crocheters, so to speak, posted a new policy that they would no longer allow pro-President Trump or pro-white nationalist post. Joining us for this conversation are Trish Fitzsimmons, the owner of local store Yarn Social. Welcome, Trish.
Thank you, Michelle.
And we also have with us on the phone, we have Shannon Downey. I love this title, Artist, Activist, and Craftivist. Welcome, Shannon.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So, Shannon, I'm going to start with you. Could you briefly describe the Ravelry kerfuffle to all the people out there who don't know anything about the world of knitting and crocheting? And I should let you know, I am like a rabid knitter, so I know it, but I'm going to let somebody else explain it.
Sure. Yeah, I'm actually not a knitter. All of my work is through embroidery. So I learned about this through the sort of digital community that was, I saw all these posts about I stand with Ravelry, and I was like, what's happening? This is like a fiber art thing.
Right.
So the idea that they are essentially banning all pro-Trump patterns, or even, I believe, like conversation and talk on their website.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate way of putting it. I know it jumped out at me because what most people don't realize is we're not talking a couple of thousand people. Ravelry has more than 8 million people on their site. How would you define craftivism?
Yeah, I think craftivism is just sort of a new term for something that's been around forever. So I love the word craftivism. It's sort of just, craft and activism like squished together, which was coined by Betsy Grier in 2003. But I think it's just sort of a new term for the idea that art has been at the center of every major political, social, and cultural revolution since the beginning of time, whether used as a medium for resisting or one of subjugating even. So I think of it as just sort of the continuation of that art and craft as a mechanism for community movement building.
Okay. I think that's a great way of putting it too. So Trish, you own a relatively new yarn store in Kansas City, and full disclosure, as with every yarn store in Kansas City, I have patronized your store. I have an indecent amount of yarn. In fact, I decided for the show, even though it's July, I'm sporting some. I hate that the listeners can't see my work, but you jumped right into this fray. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And for the listeners, she's wearing a very nice shawl. So Ravelry announced their no Trump policy at the end of June on a Sunday. It was the weekend of my goddaughter's wedding, actually. So I was sort of staying off social media, but had a few minutes to check Twitter, saw an announcement, and knew immediately that I wanted to speak up in support of what they were doing. For a knitter or crocheter, Ravelry is for most knitters or crocheters, it's sort of the center of your universe. It's a social media platform. It's where you can find out about patterns and yarn. So to me, it's how I found my knitting group when I first started knitting. It's been a huge part of my knitting life. It's part of my life as a yarn store owner. I knew it was something, again, that I wanted to support. Ravelry's always been a site that's been very transparently accepting and open and encouraging people who are not what most people might consider the traditional knitter. Knitters and crocheters tend to be viewed as sort of, you know, someone's grandma sitting in the corner in a rocking chair. And there are certainly lots of grandmas in rocking chairs on Ravelry. And then there's also people who don't look like a white grandma. It's people of color, LGBTQ people. It's also not just in the U.S. It's an international community. And they've for I think about 10 years, they have specifically banned hate speech. And then what they did at the end of last month was to include in their definition of hate speech comments, patterns, anything related to being in support of Trump and the Trump administration's policies.
You know, it's funny, whenever this topic comes up, people are always surprised that these sort of issues come up. And as a Black woman, I go, I'm always surprised at the places where it doesn't come up. And, you know, people do think, you just stated, people do tend to think of all kinds of crafts work as an old white woman thing, right? I mean, we both know that. That's the truth. So, but yet it's not. So how do you define craftivism?
So I'm a fan of Shannon's. I followed her on Instagram for a long time. So I think her definition, it resonated with me, and particularly the notion that art has always been a commentary on what's going on in the world, and that fiber arts, which is I would prefer to define knitting and crochet and that sort of thing as fiber arts.
I love that too.
A craft, because I think craft sort of suggests that it's, you know, something that like a kid would do, not to suggest that a kid can't create art as well. But I think it demeans the subject. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it's a term used to demean what's technically or rather traditionally a feminine activity. So for me, craftivism is everything back from the pink hats that you mentioned that were everywhere in 2017 to work like what Shannon does and everything in between. And then for people who are like you, a Black person or an LGBTQ person, even just your very existence while you're knitting or crocheting in maybe a public space could be considered craftivism. So it doesn't even have to be something as overt as knitting a pink hat.
I mean, I think back to I was a young reporter when the AIDS quilt came out and were making the rounds and had to cover a story involving that. And that was an eye opener for me to learn about the that's not what they called it at the time, but the LGBTQ community and those issues. I mean, do you think, and I'm going to ask you, Trish, you're not here for you to see my cues, but Trish, do you think that this is a way to open up conversation when you start knitting a pink hat? You know, I can't say what they're really called on air because I'm not trying to get us fined, lose a job, have my mother yell at me later. You know, we'll just call them the pink hats. Do you think that that's a good conversation starter for people?
I think absolutely it is. I mean, I think back, even when I was in, you know, high school and would take a history class, I always learned more about the history when I was actually in a humanities class that connected the art, the literature, the music with what was going on in the world. So I think I imagine with the AIDS quilt, I was younger then, so wasn't fully paying attention, but certainly was aware of it. I think for people who maybe might have a hard time talking about the gay community and the AIDS crisis, that was something that would sort of be an arresting image. And particularly the AIDS quilt that became such a huge, literally physically huge thing, it was unexpected. And I think having something unexpected like that is a great way to start a conversation.
What do you think about that, Shannon?
Yeah, I have a really interesting sort of connection to the AIDS quilt because I was pretty young, like maybe middle school, when I first saw the AIDS quilt and like saw images of it and started asking, like, what is this? Like, I don't understand. What is HIV? Like, I had no concept. And, you know, as folks were explaining it to me and helping me understand, I was introduced to the word gay, and I had no concept of what gay was. And the minute that I like learned that gay was a thing, or, you know, like that there was this other way of being, I was sort of like, I think I'm that. Mm. And it was really one of these moments that became like one of my first coming out moments, was just even an understanding that this existed, and that that's why I felt the way I did. And so my connection to that quilt is like, you know, wildly personal. And just, it's always been an inspiration point in my life because of that.
You know, I didn't even know that. that's a really beautiful story, because it is an example of how the physical, visible manifestation of creating something can be that portal through which somebody can walk through.
It was so interesting to like see yourself in something that isn't yours, but it opened up ways of thinking and doors that I didn't know existed, and, you know, that I could see myself in.
You know, I think, I can't remember, it might have been you, Trish, you mentioned the point that I think is really interesting about, I'm going to use the word craftivism because it's just a cute word, but you're right. I mean, I like to think of it as fiber arts too, but how it's perceived as a feminine pastime, which is why I think folks maybe, you know, take it for granted, blow it off. And yet it's always interesting. People get so impressed when they see men knitting or crocheting or cross stitching. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the things in researching is there were, what do they call them? Wool brigades during World War I, where women knitted coats into fabric because they knew that would just be passed through and nobody would pay any attention because it's just some woman's scarves. Did you guys know anything about that?
Oh, I love the espionage stories. They're some of my favorite. Just like how folks, you know, used knitting and, you know, like code writing into their work, and just went completely unaware, because who would think, right? We're so dismissed.
Exactly. You know, one of the things I've thought about, and how widely knitting and crocheting, really all of the fiber arts, has gotten, is because the more people do it, the more expansive the opportunities to do it are. I mean, I like, for example, Trish, at your store, I think it's interesting, it's called Yarn Social, because you have happy hours for people to come and sit and knit or crochet.
Absolutely, yes. My experience as a knitter is so uniquely tied to the social aspect of knitting. When I found my knitting group, I was living in New York City at the time. I didn't have a lot of friends outside of work, so I was looking for a social outlet, and then knitting helped me find that. So when I opened my store, I knew that I wanted there to be that social component. And then I also chose the name because of the notion of social justice, social rights, and I want that to be part of what we do.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, I'm still working up to it, but we've done some fundraising. We've done some things in support of the Trevor Project, the Kansas City Center for Inclusion. We're currently raising money for Racist Texas. And we actually do Ravelry pattern sales in the store. And for the month of July through the end of the month, we're donating all of the profits of what we're making from that. So, yeah, the social component for me, in all definitions of the word social, is important.
So I'm going to ask you a little bit more about that. I'm going to wait until after break. But before we get to that, so it sounds like, Trish, you already had a concept, a very firm and clear concept of how social justice and working with yarn came together. That when the Ravelry controversy came about, so to speak, you were ahead of the curve.
I guess so. I don't know that if it was necessarily so much tied to being a yarn store, but just as a business owner, I felt like it would be important and something I definitely wanted to include in sort of my business plan. And not even just necessarily fundraising. My goal is to support local makers, to provide a place for people who maybe don't feel comfortable going to other yarn stores. I mean, I'm doing what I can as a white woman, to make a space that people who are different from me can feel comfortable.
And you just left the practice of law, correct?
I did, yes.
What kind of lawyer were you?
I was a patent lawyer. I was a corporate attorney for about 14 years.
And I bring that up because, again, people have so many stereotypes about what they think a knitter, a cross stitch person looks like, what they do. You were a patent attorney in New York City, and I've been to a yarn store in New York City. So again, New York City is a place where, I know, shocking, people knit and crochet, right?
Oh, absolutely. Alan Cumming, the actor, singer, he has a nightclub in New York. And he regularly hosts knitting nights for people to come and hang out at his nightclub and knit or crochet. So, I mean, there's all sorts of amazing things going on in New York and also all sorts of amazing things in Kansas City. There is a vibrant fiber arts community here. Spinners, weavers, knitters, crocheters. Everything. Dyers, yarn dyers.
I mean, there's so many, and unfortunately I've spent my part of my paycheck on it all. This is Central Standard, and I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, filling in for Gina Kaufman this week. We're about to take a short break, and when you come back, we're going to talk a little bit about how people have responded to your positions, Trish. And we're going to hear some more from Shannon on how activism and craftivism work in her life. We'll finish up this conversation on craftivism. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, and I'm in for Gina Kaufman on Central Standard, and we're about to continue our talk with Trish Fitzsimmons, owner of Yarn Social, and Shannon Downey, artist, activist, and craftivist. So, Trish, tell me a little bit, you know I was going to get to this, about a little bit of backlash that you got as a store owner when you made the stand that sort of, you know, bounced off of Ravelry's.
Yeah, I will say, when I spoke up in support of Ravelry, I felt fairly confident that most of my customers, or the ones that I at least knew well, would support what I was saying. So I didn't feel like there was much. I wasn't really putting my business on the line. I certainly heard back from a few folks who were sad about Ravelry's decision, sad that I was supporting them, and indicated that they didn't plan to shop with me anymore, which is absolutely they're entitled to do that. Ravelry has gotten some criticism for drawing a hard line about being pro-Trump, and I think I can understand to a certain extent some of that criticism, but I think because of the way they're structured, they have a very small staff. In order to properly moderate discussions and that sort of thing, they had to draw a very clear line on the stand. But I absolutely support the notion that providing a platform for white supremacy, white nationalism, is not a thing to be part of, and certainly I support that. I absolutely want my space to be a place where everybody can feel comfortable, but particularly people who might not normally feel comfortable in a yarn store. So again, we did get a bit of pushback on our Instagram account, on our Facebook, but the vast majority of comments and every comment I've heard in person has been supportive of us. And we've actually had people specifically come and spend more than they might normally have done otherwise because they wanted to support our stance and then also our charitable giving that we're tying in connection to that this month.
I can totally see that. I mean, because again, crafts, fiber arts are about the concrete as opposed to just the air of talking about things, right? So what have you seen or heard, Shannon, in terms of backlash? Have you seen anything in terms of maybe comments you've seen on social media?
I mean, I get backlash every day, so I'm just sort of, a lot of what I do is intentionally meant to instigate, but not necessarily, I guess, agitate a little bit. And so I know that anytime I'm sort of putting a message out there, because my messages are usually like far more, they're very clear, they're very to the point, and they're calling a lot of things out. And so I fully expect the backlash with everything that I do and share. And I think that's a really healthy part of the conversation and the dialogue. And it actually makes me a better activist, because I'm hearing and getting the sort of other side, if there are sides to an argument.
So in other words, you open and invite the conversation and even the controversy to a little bit, because it's about your work. Because, you know, again, you're an activist.
Correct. Yeah.
Correct. I mean, Trish, you're a store owner, but
yeah,
Shannon,
that's
you're
so different.
You know, and Shannon, you're an activist. So those are different real approaches. Could you tell us a little bit about, don't you have a website? You tell me the name of your website, Shannon.
Shannon, it's Badass Cross Stitch.
Ooh, okay. Well, tell us a little bit more about that. That's intriguing.
Well, so Badass Cross Stitch is essentially just my art name that I created. And really, like, everything I do is around community building and community movement. Like, I like to basically do exercises where I'm attempting to meet people where they're at and then move them. And so that sometimes looks like building craftivist projects for people to participate in. I have one called Badass Herstory, where I'm essentially asking people to stitch me their story. I'm asking specifically women, female identified and gender nonconforming folks, so the most marginalized voices, to stitch me their story and send it to me.
What do you mean stitch you their story? What exactly do you mean by
that? Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So on a 12 by 12 piece of fabric, what is your story?
Cross-stitching a story. Okay.
It can be any type of fiber art.
Okay,
it's not limited to...
So I could knit you my story. I don't know what that would look like.
You totally could. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Right.
You know, and that's really about, like, how can we be the hero of our own story if we're always being taught that, like, at best, we're a supporting character? And so I think that there's a lot of folks who have not been given the space or the curiosity to explore what their story is and how that impacts their decisions and their life and how they move through the world and how they connect with others. So the project is really about that, but, like, low-key, it's a community organizing project, because I want folks getting together to work on their stories together and to support each other through that process, because it's quite challenging for a lot of people.
Do you have an example of a complete? Do you have an example of a completed project that someone's done as part of?
Oh, sure, I have thousands so far.
Okay, could you just give me this one?
They range from everything from, like, you know, storytelling through imagery. Like, this one person stitched an anatomical heart and their hand stitching it and sewing it together, like, back together, and it was a commentary on how every sort of, like, pain and struggle that they've been through has only made them stronger as they heal themselves from their trauma.
Oh, wow. And on that note, Trish, I see you're wearing a pin. What's that pin you're wearing?
So this is by a maker whose her Instagram account is Shelly Can, S-H-E-L-L-I. She did, in response to states, including Missouri, passing legislation limiting abortion access, she created a pin that is a reproductive system showing a project bag as the uterus and the ovaries are balls of yarn.
I'm sorry. I'm laughing because I'm seeing it from a distance and I could just tell that it looked like it was a knitted uterus.
Yeah.
But man, she got deep with it.
Yeah.
I mean, she really sort of embraced the whole aspect of craft and political statement.
Absolutely. I believe she donates all of her proceeds from this to Planned Parenthood. And if I can just say, for someone like me who is a white person who has plenty of privilege, and as I said before, speaking up in support of Ravelry was a pretty low risk thing for me. It's folks like Shannon. It's the people of color, particularly women of color, who I've learned about through Instagram, who have really done, you know, the lion's share of work around making the fiber arts community a space that is open for everyone, and who have really done a lot to open my eyes, particularly over this, just in the course of the last 6 or 7 months. So it's we owe folks like them for a debt of gratitude for speaking up and helping educate and doing so much of, you know, sort of the emotional labor of helping to open my eyes and the eyes of people like me. So it's I'm grateful for all the artists out there, for makers who have given me an easy way to sort of wear my craftivist as a badge of honor.
So, I mean, that, and you're right. I mean, there's a lot of people who are out there doing that work. Shannon, you have, I think I'm reading this right, 100,000 followers on Instagram?
That is true.
And do you think that you're seeing people take this conversation to higher ground? Are you seeing more people, you know, follow you on Instagram as part of this?
Yeah, absolutely. I am so grateful for that digital community. I can't even describe it, because the conversations that happen on there, like, there was like a moment where I did not believe that social media could be a tool for good. Like, I was running a digital marketing company for 10 years and I was just like, I don't understand. Like, I think that this is just like, it's just turning toxic. And I worked, especially, you know, the Instagram community, like, I worked really hard to sort of model the kind of conversations that I wanted to see happening on Instagram and the kind of generosity and empathy and compassion that I wanted to see. And immediately that's what happened. And so everybody on that platform that interacts, not everybody, okay, mostly everybody on that platform that's interacting is doing it with such grace and really still having hard conversations and challenging and not avoiding the hard topics, but doing it in a way that like brings hope back to me about like how these tools can be used for organizing and for community mobilizing. So it's like, I'm so grateful for it. And Trish, thank you. I'm so grateful for what you just said. That was so lovely.
Thanks.
You know, it's interesting because on the one hand, doing fiber art is very zen and peaceful and calming and meditating. But on the other hand, it involves sharp objects. and folks need to remember that, that you know, people are willing to, you know, deal with some sharp objects while they're working on things. So Trish, as part of wrapping up the conversation, what do you think are the long-term implications of you putting your foot in it, so to speak? You're standing tall and strong on your position on this.
Well, I think I hope to continue to learn and evolve my own sort of perspective on the world and find ways that I can help improve things. It helps me sort of deal with my own personal emotional feelings about the state of our country and the state of politics and all of that. So a lot of selfish things, but also I can just hope that I can help the Kansas City community have this conversation.
Wow, this is great. This has been an awesome conversation. Trish Fitzsimmons, owner of Yarn Social here in Kansas City, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Shannon Downey, I really appreciate you. You are an artist, activist, and craftivist, and she goes by Badass Cross Stitch, and she lives in Chicago. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So that's it for today. You can get everything from this morning show at kcur.org/Central Standard later today. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, we'll hear about how Major League Baseball is becoming friendlier to Spanish-speaking players. That's tomorrow at 10 a.m. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, with help from Chris Young, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and Knigrendorf, and intern Riley Keister. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoon Bender Labs. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, in for Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next, so please don't go away.